Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
3 days on doesn't get any easier. What happens after Newtown? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 17th of December. Good as always to have you with us. In Newtown, Connecticut today, the funerals have started. Two so far, Jack Pinto and Noah Posner. Although I don't know how you say goodbye to a pair of six-year-old boys. Investigators, meanwhile, said it's going to take months to figure out exactly what happened before and after the shootings on Friday. But there is going to be a familiar pattern to how the bigger story is going to play out about what we do in response. We know because we've seen it before. We have a crisis or a tragedy. People propose new policies. Lawmakers in Washington debate what those policies ought to be. And then groups get involved to help those lawmakers make up their minds. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
The NRA is the largest gun lobby, and it's got a reputation in this town. That's because of all the money at its disposal. Graham Wilson chairs the political science department at Boston University.
The word in Washington is that crossing the National Rifle Association is dangerous.
It's been known to pour hundreds of thousands of dollars into a single congressional race. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow at the Sunlight Foundation. During the last election cycle, the NRA spent more than $24 million.
The money on one side is enormous. The money on the other side is tiny.
In contrast, Drutman says, the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, that's the largest gun control organization, spent just $5,816 during the election. Total. Neither group responded to our requests for interviews. The NRA's cash advantage could serve as a powerful check against any new gun control efforts. Sheila Krumholtz runs the Center for Responsive Politics, and she says the NRA is already gearing up for the 2014 midterm elections.
The NRA alone has given to more than 290 candidates already this cycle, so far this cycle. So that's a lot of money in a lot of pockets in Washington.
Lee Drutman with the Sunlight Foundation calls the NRA a textbook political organization because its members make it so effective. There are more than 4 million of them, and the NRA's membership has grown after other mass shootings.
The NRA gets more members at times when gun control law is on the table. In the wake of Columbine, they increased their membership by about 50%.
When it comes to money and to members, there's not an organization on the other side of the gun control issue that compares. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There is a smattering of what seems like slightly less relevant political news out of Washington to tell you about. First of all, the fiscal cliff. Speaker of the House John Boehner met with President Obama today. About 45 minutes, we're told. Nothing they'd care to talk about afterward, though. Although, in a conversation this weekend, Mr. Boehner did apparently say he is open to higher tax rates on millionaires. So maybe there's progress, maybe there's not. The budgetary tea leaf reading continues. In foreign policy, the tea leaves are a bit more clear. Word is that Senator John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, currently the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is going to be the next Secretary of State. If that does happen, it's going to mean a third Senate race in Massachusetts in a little bit over 3 years. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch has more now on the business of the political season that just keeps on a giving.
Who said anything about a fiscal cliff? Another special election back here would be
like a stimulus package for the media.
Toby Berkovitz teaches advertising at Boston University.
Because it's such a short track in terms of when the primary and then the general is, the money comes in fast and furious.
What's unusual is that this race would be coming on the heels of two other ginormous ones. In 2010, candidates raised more than $40 million in the special election to replace Ted Kennedy. Scott Brown won that one. This year, he lost re-election, but not before he and his opponent spent more than $76 million, much of it on TV ads.
I'm Scott Brown, and I approve this message.
Elizabeth Warren is trying to put questions about her hair.
The most expensive Senate race ever also filled the pocketbooks of political consultants, who may now be getting an unexpected gift.
Well, this will be three Christmases.
Tufts University political scientist Jeff Berry says another special election means more money coming in from outside the state.
It's a net importer of dollars. I'm not sure it's a viable economic strategy for Massachusetts.
But ad guy Toby Berkovitz says this spending could have a long tail, say if the winner is a sitting House member.
Then all of a sudden you have an open congressional seat. Who knows? This could end up being a giant Ponzi scheme with race after race, dollar after dollar.
Making general managers of TV and radio stations here firm believers in the political process. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nikisch for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, hopes of progress on that fiscal cliff seem to have cheered traders up a little tiny bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're doing a lot of your holiday shopping online this year, join the club because there is nothing like that Amazon box miraculously just showing up on your doorstep out of nowhere. And as more of us await packages at home, the companies whose job it is to get those boxes to us are getting smarter about their deliveries. Audrey Quinn has more.
This time of year, if you're a delivery truck driver, you'd better be ready to go.
Good morning, everybody!
Good morning!
That time again! 9, 8, 7!
We're at the UPS Distribution Center in Secaucus, New Jersey. Drivers gather in the center of the warehouse. They call it peak season around here. Driver Marco Moreno shows me the back of his truck. Wow, it's packed. How many packages do you think are in here?
On a normal day, I deliver about 300 boxes. On our peak season, it should be about 500 to 600. That's only in one street.
Why so many extra?
Online shoppers.
To handle all those extra packages, UPS has to get really good at keeping track of them. That little device you sign when you get a delivery, it's actually a handheld computer that has a log for each package in the truck. It also tracks everything a driver like Moreno does.
So when you're driving, what kind of things are they monitoring?
It tracks my speed.
His idling time.
My seatbelt wearing, if the doors are open or closed.
It tracks when he backs up, how far he backs up.
I think that's it.
And when Moreno makes the delivery?
UPS. Hello.
His device records that that package has been delivered. All this data helps UPS save money by making routes more efficient. And the guy who gets all this tracking data?
My name is Jack Levis. I'm a director of process management for UPS.
Levis oversees a full team of mathematicians in a boring office outside of Baltimore. But it's here that all the shipping plans for UPS packages get their start. Using drivers' data, Levis's mathematicians create maps. They look at how drivers got from one location to another in the past to figure out the most efficient routes for the future. For this year's extra online deliveries, they've come out with a whole new routing algorithm. It's 80 pages long.
I can't read it, but that's what it is. It's 80 pages of math formulas. It solves a delivery route in about 3 seconds.
It's not just UPS that's striving for hyper-efficiency. Online shopping's changed the nature of shipping in general. Gary Giddings is at Penn State's College of Business. He says products used to all ship out in big truckloads to retail stores. But with online shopping, the products need to be dropped at every single doorstep.
So now we're trying to figure out, well, how in a cost-effective way can items be delivered in single quantities or very small quantities into the home?
But that personal service is costly.
While somebody may sell you a product and say it's free shipping, and it's just rolled into their price that they're charging you. It's a wonderful marketing tool, and everybody's attracted to it, including me and my wife. but there is really no such thing as free shipping.
Giddings says the number of purchases we order online will continue to grow. He says shipping will become even more efficient. It could even get a bit creepy.
And I assume you don't want me to talk about the crazy robots driving around the neighborhood, right?
In New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
We spent some time out in Rolla, Missouri this summer and fall, telephonically, that is. We talked to a cattle rancher named Ken Lennox a couple of times about hay, mostly, and about how he had to buy it in the summertime, which was unusual, because the drought meant there was no grass for his cattle to feed on. It's been a couple of months, so we called him back up today. Mr. Lennox, good to talk to you again.
Yes, it's good to hear from you.
You know what's interesting is, I mean, other than these stories we do dipping in and out of the drought, it does seem to have sort of faded from the news, and yet you guys still have to deal with it every single day.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. We had rain the last of August, September, and October, and it shut off in November. We've had virtually nothing November and into December. So we're right back in drought mode, only there's nothing growing anyway, so it's not bothering us as much, except for the springs and the pond water. They'll drink a lot of water, a cow will, in the wintertime as well as in the heat of the summer.
What happens in the springtime if you're still feeding, you know, hay in, say, you know, May-ish?
Well, that would be a disaster. I mean, because your hay stocks would be gone. You know, what will happen and has happened before, you get a late spring. You get those hard frosts all the way through April. And I have fed all the way through April, but only, I think, twice in about 40 years. Hmm. So, you know, that's not associated with the drought, but that would... I don't even want to think about that.
All right. Well, let's not then. once you get these cattle through the wintertime, when can you start thinking about selling them off and getting a little bit of your investment back?
Well, my normal sale date is sometime in June. You know, while I still have the good grass, the cattle are gaining good. And then you get into the heat of the summer, and there's no calves on the cows, so the cows do a lot better. Hmm. Now, that's for somebody that calves them in the fall and sells them in the spring. If you calve them in the spring and sell them in the fall, you've got a completely different set of worries.
Yeah, I bet. But I didn't know you guys had a choice as to when you calved them or not. I thought that was just nature, you know?
No, it's a lot easier to take care of them when they calve in the fall. You don't have those wet, snowy days in February and March when they're calving, and that's not fun to look forward to either.
Yeah, I bet. It's interesting. It's a lifestyle for you, but it's a business too, huh?
Yes, sir. It's not a hobby. It's a business.
Ken Lennox. He ranches cattle out in Rolla, Missouri. Mr. Lennox, thanks a lot for your time.
Well, thank you.
We've got some pictures of Mr. Lennox at his farm. They're on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, our series Food for 9 Billion continues.
We waste about 40% of the food that's produced. That's 1,400 calories per person per day. That is greenhouse gas emissions that never needed to have happened.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hopes for some kind of fiscal cliff deal did seem to move the markets today. The Dow Industrial's up 100 points, 0.75%, closed at 13,235. The NASDAQ picked up 39 points, about 1.3%. Ended at 3010. The S&P 500 up 16 points, 1.2%, closed at 1430. Financials led the ascent, as they tend to do. Citigroup deposited 4%. Bank of America brought in about the same. Goldman Sachs added close to 3.5% today. Housing stocks raised the roof a little bit. KB Home and Pulte Group both climbed more than 5%. A poll by Pulte, by the way, a big majority of homeowners said they wanted bigger homes. Toll Brothers packed on nearly 4.5%. Lennar nailed a 4% gain today. Small creatures paid off big for Time Warner in an unexpected journey. The new Hobbit movie blew out the box office this weekend. Shares in Time Warner, parent of Warner Brothers, grew 2.5% today. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.77%, which is, in the recent terms, pretty high. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. The United Nations observes International Migrants Day. One statistic they give, 49% of migrants worldwide are women. And it's the anniversary of a holiday tradition. Tchaikovsky's ballet, The Nutcracker, premiered in St. Petersburg on December 18, 1882. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. At a cool $85 million, the new movie The Hobbit now has the box office record for December opening weekends. The fantasy adventure is in what's called wide release. That's more than 4,000 screens out there. Thing about this movie, though, is that before you even get to the theater, you have to decide how you want to see it. Shireen Marisol Meraji did some calling around.
Thank you for calling the Burbank AMC 16. How may I help you?
Hi, I have a question about The Hobbit. How many different ways are you guys showing it?
You have the IMAX 3D, which is in the high frame rate, regular 2D, ETX 3D, which is not high frame rate, but it is mastered for Dolby Atmos, and then you have regular 3D.
Did you follow that? I think he mentioned four different ways, and that's not even all the options available.
It's kind of like going to the grocery store and you want to go get cereal. There's 100 different cereals to choose from.
Brian Yudovich is a movie producer here in LA for Rough and Tumble Films.
The studio is trying to give you whatever options you want.
He says in cases like The Hobbit, a movie that people are going to watch no matter what, it makes smart business sense to offer a range of viewing experiences at different price points, which takes me back to my phone call with the Burbank AMC 16.
The IMAX 3D is going to cost the most. The ETX will be a dollar or two less than that. Regular 3D will be just underneath that, and then regular 2D will be the base price.
Across the country in New York, Rezwana Zafar is waiting at a theater in Times Square to see The Hobbit in old-fashioned 2D.
I'm not really a big fan of 3D, and I'm a little skeptical about the new technology that's out. I heard a lot of reviews about it being too realistic, and you can see the set.
Zafar says she doesn't want to pay more money for that kind of realism. But L.A.-based film producer Brian Yudovich says it's not just about money. It's about advancing the art form.
They're trying something, and maybe it'll catch and maybe it won't. But this has always happened in any art form. And if you look at cinema, it went from being a silent to a talkie. It went from being black and white to color.
And that's why Yudovich says with all the choices before him, he's going to see The Hobbit the way director Peter Jackson intended, in high frame rate, 3D. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
In a federal courtroom in Ohio today, it's all color, cut, clarity, and carrots. Diamonds are on trial, in a sense. At issue is a multi-million dollar ad campaign by the diamond retailer Zales and about what it can say about its diamonds. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
This is the statement that started the kerfuffle between Zales and its competitors.
This is the Celebration Fire, the most brilliant diamond in the world.
A federal judge in Ohio is deciding if Zales can make this claim. Roxanne Berry is the director of investor relations for Zales Corporation. She says the lawsuit is without merit.
Our advertising was based upon testing by a qualified independent laboratory, and our ads make that fact clear.
Fred Cuellar wrote the number one selling book on diamonds, How to Buy a Diamond. He says it's very easy to tell if Zales' claim is true.
It's simple. There's a formula you follow. Efficiency rating times amplified light return equals weighted light return. Remember, a photon of light is a boson. Bosons are not fermions. Am I losing you?
Yes, I was lost at weighted light return. Luckily, Cuellar broke it down for me. He said if Sterling, the company that is suing Zales, argues that the brilliance of a diamond is subjective,
they're wrong and they're toast.
But Cuellar says if Sterling argues that Zales didn't do the proper test to determine the brilliance of the diamond, then they have a case.
I studied everything that they did with the Celebration Diamond, and they didn't follow the protocol. And so they actually can't make the claim based on the way they did the test on their 50-something stones.
If Zales loses the case, they'll have to pull their ad campaign in the midst of the holiday season. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
There are more than 7 billion people living on this planet right now, 9 billion by the middle of the century probably, which gave us the title for the series we've been working on all this year about how to keep those mouths fed, Food for 9 Billion, it's called. And we've looked at how to boost production without destroying the environment, how to deal with water shortages, and how to slow population growth and cut down on waste. And yeah, sometimes questions like that can feel pretty abstract, especially at a time of year when it seems like all we do is eat. But as John Miller reports, we are part of the picture, too.
If you look at all the challenges facing food producers around the world, you could argue that the most daunting one is climate change. Higher temperatures, higher sea levels, crazy weather. Well, it turns out our food system isn't just challenged by climate change. It's also one of the biggest sources of greenhouse gas. Most of it comes from the production end. Methane from cattle, nitrous oxide from fertilizer, CO2 from cutting down trees. But several recent studies have concluded that we will never be truly food secure unless we change the way we eat. Which is why I went to Baltimore.
Union Mill is one of the mills that was built from native stone. So that's what you see here, these incredible old walls from the late 1800s.
That's Spike Jerde, that's G-J-E-R-D-E, in a coffee house he recently opened called Artifact. Jerde's other restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, has gotten national press for its seasonal, locally sourced food.
It's true that the entire focus and our commitment is to local direct sourcing of all of our ingredients.
Also here today is Ronnie Neff, that's N-E-F-F.
And I am the Research and Policy Director at the Center for a Livable Future at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
And an expert in the connection between climate change and diet. And I'm here because I've given Jerde and Neff a challenge to shop for and prepare a festive, not-so-expensive, not-so-hard-to-make, climate-friendly meal for a national radio audience. I figured they'd have a menu worked out, but they don't.
So can I ask what you have in mind?
Gonna see what's in the market, and I don't have a lot in mind.
Okay.
Do you have any ideas?
Jerde says we've gotten used to having everything available all the time, like tomatoes in the winter, which she says make no sense in a place like Baltimore.
You have to be more flexible. Go to the market and see what's good.
I like making my decisions in the store.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's the best way to go for tamping down the worst angels of our nature.
The ones that want tomatoes in February?
Yeah, tomatoes in February and Captain Crunch year-round.
There is no Captain Crunch at the Belvedere Market. It's like a mini indoor farmer's market with a cafe, a butcher, a fishmonger. Jerde heads straight to the produce section.
He's got an amazing, beautiful kind of array of squash here. I think the Blue Hubbards, which are one of my favorite kind of all-around squash, were grown nearby in Pennsylvania.
I know Jerde's big into local, but Neff is the expert on climate.
When something is produced locally, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have lower greenhouse gas emissions than something that's produced farther away.
That's because a truck traveling 50 miles with a load of, say, apples can emit more greenhouse gas per apple than a ship carrying a huge load halfway around the world. But Neff says for most foods, transportation isn't that big a part of the carbon footprint.
So it's not the first place we look when we want to make a change.
That place would be meat. According to the Environmental Working Group, every pound of beef coughs up 27 pounds of greenhouse gas. Compare that to about 2 pounds for most fruits and vegetables. The difference adds up.
If a four-person family just took out meat and cheese just one day a week, it would be the same as taking their car off the road for 5 weeks. So it's huge.
Pork and poultry are better than beef and lamb. So, for the most part, is seafood.
So what we're looking at here are oysters. For us living in Baltimore and Maryland around the Chesapeake Bay, farmed Chesapeake Bay oysters are one of the few things that are just almost as clearly a win for the environment, for our local food system, as there is.
Oysters feed by filtering seawater, and they absorb carbon to make their shells. On the other hand, they need to be refrigerated, and it takes a lot of energy to move them around. Clearly, Maryland oysters make total sense in Baltimore in December. How about Kansas City in July? The math can get complicated.
Consumers really need more information. A lot of it is just taking guesses and using our best judgment.
Neff gives the oysters the thumbs up. Jerde grabs some kale, a few turnips, a couple of apples, and a bottle of local wine. And because he just can't resist, a little chunk of bacon on the way out.
This is my friend Ben.
A friend of Jerde's is waiting for us when we get back to the cafe. He's Ben Lambert, also a chef.
So I thought I'd invite him to come in and cook with us. Kind of a little bit of a ringer.
Beautiful. Bring a ringer in.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Cool.
Right?
Lambert cuts the squash into oblong slices, drizzles them with oil, and sticks them in the oven. Jerde stirs a pot of barley with a little bit of the bacon for seasoning.
I'm still not clear what we're having for dinner. You're making this up as you go along, I think.
Absolutely.
Beyond some peels and stems, it's a tidy kitchen. Ronnie Neff says a big part of climate-friendly eating is cutting down on waste.
We waste about 40% of the food that's produced. That's 1,400 calories per person per day. That is greenhouse gas emissions that never needed to have happened.
That's not counting all the extra food people like me eat just because it's there. Dinner's ready in about an hour. The finished product is pretty impressive. We get a boat-shaped wedge of golden squash piled with barley, julienne apples, and a sprinkling of greens. There's also a little cylinder of kale that's been squeezed and rolled and seasoned with garlic. Instead of lemon for the raw oysters, there's a sauce made from minced red onion and sour grape juice from a local winery.
Oh, it's so good. And I think this is exactly the point that was made, is that you can eat climate-friendly and eat the best food in the world. It's delicious.
It is delicious and festive and not too expensive and really not too hard to make. Granted, it's a little hard to imagine all of America switching to squash and kale and turnips for the winter. But for tonight, I can say we could do worse. In Baltimore, I'm John Miller for Marketplace.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions, PBS NewsHour, and the Center for Investigative Reporting. If you want to know how you can eat a little more climate-friendly, we've got some tips, of course, online, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, some numbers from the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press about the shootings in Newtown. 57% of Americans say they are following this story very closely, which is interesting. But what's more interesting, though, even than that, and does give an indicator of the policy debates to come that we talked about up at the top of the broadcast, is why people think those shootings happened. 44% said shootings like these are the isolated acts of troubled individuals. 47% said it's about broader problems in society. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 100 points, about 0.75%. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 added 16 points. That is 1.2%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Julie Podokas. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.